This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
My job is driving me crazy.
Sorry.
Do you hate your job or does your job hate you?
Sorry. Sorry, I can't find the answer to the question I heard.
My career crisis.
Hi, Sue.
Hello.
It's the end of series one.
Yes, it's gone quick, really.
It's been amazing, hasn't it?
Mm.
What a journey. We've had some incredible stories from our guests who've come on to share their career crisis. Everything from having a baby with whilst running a small business and not wanting to tell your business partner to, I mean, one of the main themes, I think, really is creativity versus money. Definitely. We've come back to that time and time again.
Mm.
And also confidence. Do you think there's something about women nowadays at a certain point in their careers? A lot of the people we've spoken to have been kind of mid-30s through to mid-40s, who their career crisis is more a crisis of confidence than anything else.
Yeah, I think you'd sum up most of the examples that we've had about confidence. And,
yeah.
And when you see, you know, from our point of view, these wonderful women coming in and you think, what have you got to be unconfident about?
Right.
But it's interesting. I mean, if I had, when I'm rule the world, which is not going to happen anytime soon, I would actually have sort of confidence building in the curriculum at school.
Yeah.
You know, when my daughter was at school, she went to a girls' school, and I did a regular thing where I went and helped, you know, and just taught confidence and stuff, because I think it's a really good thing to do. If you get them early, not so that they're bolshy or precocious, but just, you know, you're as important as anybody else. You're not more important, you're not less important. Just think on that.
What are your top tips for confidence training? Just putting you on the spot then. Top three things would you do?
Well, that one, I'm always saying to my kids, you know, look, you are as important as anybody else. Even if that person's more senior than you, obviously they have greater responsibility. But you are as important, and that enables you, if you feel that somebody is doing something which is affecting the way that you're doing your work or whatever, well, I have to go and tell them because I'm as important as they are. You know, it's difficult to keep hold of that. But I do think it's got to be running through you. I think the second thing, in Catelyn Moran's book, which is, I recommend, How to Build a Girl, which is very funny. But she says, you know, fake it till you make it. And I think sometimes the appearance of confidence, looking as though you know what you're doing, can help you to sort of get in. And then you think, oh, actually, I can do this. And another thing I think is just if you're a bit worried about doing something, say to yourself, what is the worst thing that could happen? And usually it's not much. So why don't you try and do it? And if you get it wrong, you'll learn something. People seem to be terrified of making mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, in our last podcast, we talked about unrealistic standards, regretting what you've done wrong. Every time I've done something wrong, it's taught me something. And if I hadn't done those things, I wouldn't be the person I am now. So don't even make mistakes. We all do it. You know, I mean, obviously, if you're a doctor, please don't listen to what I've just said. But anybody else, mate, you can, or a bus driver or an airline pilot, but everybody else, you can make mistakes.
Yeah, you get the idea, basically. yeah, it's something that's always been on my mind since having a girl as well. I think it's a very feminine trait, and, you know, society, for, you know, whatever mad patriarchal reasons, likes to give women issues, you know, everything from women's magazines that, you know, you've regularly railed against on this podcast, and I completely agree with you, to making us feel bad about ourselves in whatever way possible, whether it's we're not strong enough, we're not fit enough, we're not pretty enough, we're not thin enough, we're not clever enough. And I think that girls, more than boys, have far more pressure put on them. I mean, maybe I'm being far too, you know, I know I'm being very simplistic, but, you know, we have just had a full series of women coming to us with these kind of issues.
I think we mustn't blame it all on the patriarchy, because I think women bear some responsibility as this. I mean, it's interesting, you know, when you have a girl child, because I've always tried, and it's so hard not to say, be careful. It's really, you know, it's on the tip of your tongue. Be careful, be careful. And what you're actually saying is, so don't risk, don't try, don't, you know. And I wanted her to always just get a bit outside her comfort zone, do what she, and if she, and all I ever said to her was, do your best, you know, not get A's, just do your best. If she came back from an exam and it hadn't gone very well, I'd just say, did you do your best? Yes, that's all I can ask for. And I think that's just do your best is quite a good motto, really.
My dad had a great way of dealing with our report cards for my sister and I when we were teenagers, which was the report card would come in, and at our school they'd put your percentage and then they'd put the average of the class. And my dad didn't care what that average was and what my mark was. He just wanted me to be above average. And he would always say that to me. He'd just go, what was the average? I'd say, oh, Dad, I got like, you know, 49%. And he'd say, what was the average? What was the average? As long as I was above average. And that's something that has just been ingrained in my head my whole life, is just to be alternative. It's good to be alternative. That was something else he used to say to us. But were you above the average?
But those messages are so important. Mm. I mean, I had a very, very different background, in that my dad, I did used to come top in the class a lot. And I remember once I brought a report card home and I came second, and he just let me have it because I came second.
Wow.
Now, my sister, who used to come seventh or eighth, if she came ninth, he didn't say anything. But because I was first, I think it's also to do with that being the oldest child, because parents' expectations are much higher on oldest children. A lot of research bears that out. A lot of older children and only children are higher achieving simply because they have to be. Their expectations are very, very, they have to meet their parents' expectations. And I've always tried to be, even though it hasn't come easily, very laid back with my kids. You know, do your best. That's all I want. And your best is good enough for me. And sometimes they've been quite honest and they've said, I didn't do my best. And then I say, I'm disappointed.
But even that kind of self-recognition of something you've done yourself, I think is healthy.
Absolutely.
To admit that and just say, right, okay, I'm sorry, I've let you down. Let's move on. Well, what we wanted to do on this episode of My Career Crisis is share some of your stories, because people have got in touch with us by email mainly, and on Twitter at My Career Crisis, to just share some of their stories. And we thought we'd kind of make it a post bag episode and go through some of these messages we've got. A lot of them quite personal as well. So I thought I'd start with one that I was like, come on, no one has this problem, do they? And then Sue, of course, goes, actually, I've had to deal with this, because you've had to deal with everything, which is from Aisha, who got in touch with us on Twitter. And she just said, I'm working with someone with bad BO. Do I tell them? Does this really happen?
Yes. Yes, it does. It does more than you'd think. Right. So a couple of questions I'd have. First of all, what is her position vis-a-vis this colleague? So is it someone she manages, or is it someone she's beside? I mean, if you manage somebody, I think it's your job to tell them.
Now, in your position, were you managing someone?
I was managing somebody, but I was completely gutless about it. I remember he came into my department for a 6-month sort of stint. And he was going to be training people. And I had noticed he was a bit whiffy, but I tried to pretend I hadn't, because I did not want to have that conversation. And one of his colleagues came to me and said, have you noticed he's quite smelly? And I, to my shame, I said, is he? Really? He goes, well, yeah, and I think you should have a word. Now, I did try and pass the buck. I did try and say, do you not think it would come better from a man? You know, mano a mano. And he said, no, I think it would come better from the manager. And I thought, yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah.
So what I was due to see him at the end of the first week, just to give him some feedback about how he's done that week. And to be fair to him, apart from this quite huge thing, his behaviour had been exemplary. He'd picked up things very quickly. And for me, it's always a question, and I think this is going to affect some of the other things we're going to talk about. You know, why am I having this conversation? And for me as a manager, it was, is he doing something that's affecting his work, my work, the team's work, the end product? And it was going to affect his ability to work with other people. So I thought, I have to say it to him. So we had the general feedback, and then I said, did you know, or, when you're telling people, I do this in coaching sometimes, if you're telling somebody something that you don't think they know, or they're not really aware of the impact, start the sentence with, did you know? So I, did you know that you've got quite a strong body odour? Now, that's where I made my mistake, because I should have just shut up and let him answer me. But of course, I was feeling quite nervous. Mm-hmm. So I started to gabble. And I said, you know, because the reason that we have to do this, when we're working quite closely with people, and obviously, you know, that's going to get in the way. And I just thought, just shut up. And in the end, I said, look, I think I may have upset you. If you ask a question, it pushes it onto the other person. And he got up and he said, no, I'm not upset. I'm quite shocked nobody's ever spoken to me like this. And he sort of flounced out. And then I spent the weekend worrying that he'd thrown himself under a bus. Mm-hmm. But on the Monday, he came in and he was minty fresh. So I don't know what he'd done, but he was obviously fine. And I just tried to behave as though we'd never had the conversation. He was quite sheepish with me for a couple of days, and then he got into the groove. This was obviously so traumatic that I wiped it from my memory, which I have a habit of doing. And at the end of the attachment, when he was supposed to go back to his original job, I did an appraisal with him, and I just said how well he'd done, because he played it wonderfully. He did an exemplary attachment with me. He was one of the best people I'd ever had. And he said to me, I said, have you got any feedback for me? And he said, yes, I'd just like to say how much I've liked working with you. And I said, oh, that's really nice to know. And he said, and also, I'd like to say thank you for what you said to me at the beginning of the attachment. And I stupidly said, what did I say to you at the beginning of the attachment?
Oh, no.
And he said, you know, when you told me I was smelly.
Oh.
And I thought, oh, my God. And I said, I don't think I used those exact words. And he went, no. He said, you did it very well in retrospect. I think I was a bit upset. And this is the bit that got me reaching for the Kleenex. He said, I've looked back and a lot of things in my life have started making sense. And he said, I'd like to thank you because I think you changed my life.
Whoa.
Yeah, well, I was so proud of myself. But what it taught me was, right, first of all, I have to ask myself this question. Why am I having this conversation with this person? Because I want to help them. Now, I can talk to them about it. It doesn't mean they're going to do anything about it. So, but what's my responsibility? So I told him and it had a happy ending. I'm not naive enough to think it would always end like that. But what's the alternative, right? So you either ignore it. Now, if it's a colleague, it's obviously more difficult because you don't have the authority. But somebody said to me once, you know, we could leave some antiperspirant on their desk. Oh, yes, that so works. You know, they come in and go, whose antiperspirant is this? So if you feel for this person, if it's affecting your ability to do your job or it's their ability to do their job, then I think you have to say something.
Yeah.
You know, and you're doing a kindness.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that your story absolutely proves that. Here we've got another one here. Nat, my boss always comments on my weight. I can't believe this, quite honestly, in a roundabout passive-aggressive way. Like when I'm off out to lunch or she catches me with my mouth full. I'm so self-conscious now, I don't like to eat in the office.
She doesn't mention whether the weight thing is overweight or underweight. I'm assuming it's overweight.
I'd imagine so, yeah, yeah.
Right. You know, you just want to give these people a slap, don't you? Right. If I was a manager, if I was training this manager, what I would say to them is, you know, when you want, it's very germane to what we've just been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Why do I make comments like this? Now, I'm just really stretching credibility, credulity here, but I'm just trying to work out why would this be relevant? Now, let's supposing somebody's weight is affecting them. It's affecting their ability to do their job. Let's say they do look distracted or sluggish or, you know, as they've put on weight, their work effort has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Then it might be worth talking to them about their health.
Like it's been a rapid weight gain across a number of months, or rapid weight loss actually at the same.
But my, if in the managerial role, my question would always be, so why do you want to have this conversation? Now, if you can say to me as a manager, it's affecting their ability to do their job. And if they'd lost a dramatic amount of weight, I care about my staff and I'd like to know that they're okay. If, for example, they're then having days off illness. Now, I think that's a genuine concern. But this sounds more to me. Often you get people who perhaps, you know, maybe she's somebody with rigid iron control who never lets a bit of bread past her lips.
Mm.
And one of the ways she copes with that way of living is to say to other people, you know, often we say to people what we don't like about ourselves. Mm. Now, the question is, how does she deal with this? Mm. First of all, when people say to me, you know, they make me feel bad, right? No. You do that all on your own. But somebody can offer you bad, you have to take it. So first of all, why are you so upset about it? It's not nice, right? But there's not nice, and it's really getting to me. So which is it? One way would be is to confront her. But you've got to have confidence to do this, and you've got to be careful. I mean, one way of it might be, you know, you mentioned my weight a lot. Do you feel that this is having an effect on my ability to do my job? Mm. Do you think it's affecting my work?
Especially if this person is quite junior and it's a boss who's obviously using it as a power play, it sounds to me.
I mean, I'm old enough and ugly enough and fat enough to not care. So if somebody spoke to me like that, I would laugh because I just think it's ludicrous. As long as I'm confident that I'm doing my job and my work hasn't slackened off in any way and I know I'm good at my job, I just think, lady, this is your problem, mm-hmm. you know. You know, if it went on, I know I probably would say something. But the way to say it is, I notice that you pick up on my weight quite a lot. Do you think that that's affecting my ability to do my job? I think you'd only say it once because I don't think she'd carry on after that.
No way.
It's interesting, this whole thing about weight, because you're actually not protected in any kind of law.
No.
Unless your weight is so severe, under or over, that it becomes a disability. So, you know, even in America, they've been trying to get this onto statute for a long time, but you have to prove that you are actually disabled and therefore you are being discriminated against because you're disabled. And it seems to be the last thing that people can have a go about,
mm-hmm.
you know. That being ginger, yeah. I think those are the two legal things that we can get away with.
Yeah.
You know, but people don't mind saying, you know, they're a pig or they're fat or whatever.
It's a form of bullying.
Would you be so dismissive of any other group? No. So I think you need to think about what you say to people.
Just sounds real. I just still can't believe that someone would do that in this day and age.
Oh, sadly, I can.
I seem to say that a lot these days, in this day and age.
My career crisis. My career crisis.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I've got a lovely, quite a long story here from a listener who was working in a very busy restaurant environment. And she says she has PTSD and panic disorder. And she was struggling a lot with depression and anxiety at the time. She had worked in a branch of this restaurant who'd been very supportive of her issues. She'd been upfront about it. She's young. She'd told her manager her problems, but they made a way for her to work. She then moved to London to a very busy branch of the same restaurant, and she had a total nightmare from people being very nasty to her quite openly, and going to work made her very, very depressed. One girl was very rude to her for no reason, really started, you know, she was trying to make an effort to be nice. No one was interested in who I was, she says. There was a feeling of real sadness when she was working there. She didn't, I mean, this just makes me so mad. I didn't get included in the Secret Santa. I don't know why, and I got no explanation or apology for this, even from the manager. And that kind of seemingly so silly thing can really destroy someone's confidence, especially when they're already struggling with issues. She was crying at work, having panic attacks. Anyway, she's gone into loads of detail here, and thank you so much for getting in touch. But she then says that her mother basically said to her, you have to quit and go back to the original place you were working, leave London. And the upshot is, she says, she's now working somewhere where she's really happy. She's working in a bar while she's finishing her master's. Everyone's very understanding and very supportive of her situation. So she's really just got in touch to kind of say, this is my experience of having these issues and how I had this awful experience and now I have a good experience. What would your advice be for someone who, you know, knows they have these problems but also needs to just have a job and work and make money, in terms of taking that with you into the office or the, you know, wherever you're working?
I think, well done, mum, for a start.
Yes.
I think your first concern, you know, going back to what we said at the beginning, I'm as important as anybody else. But that also means I have to take responsibility for myself. And if you're not well, you need to get well. And working in a very busy restaurant when you have PTSD and anxiety attacks probably is not the best marriage. And in fact, I think she was very lucky that in that first instance, she did get an understanding manager. I mean, yes, all managers should be like that, but they're also trying to run a business. You know, I think it was hats off to that guy who employed her in the first place, because I think that was wonderful. But that's quite difficult to manage, and you'd have to be really mature to deal with that. She comes down to London, where most catering staff are quite transient anyway, you know, because I think working in that sort of catering restaurant must be quite stressful if you're a manager, trying to make sure you've got the quality of staff and whatever. And she arrived with a load of problems. Now, I think he should have been much more sympathetic, but it was an accident waiting to happen. So she took the decision that even though there were these things that were wrong, she was putting herself in a place of real vulnerability. She was moving away from her support network, her dear mum, who obviously loves her very much. And I'm not saying that she shouldn't ever come to London again, but be well first.
Yeah.
It's a tough place if you haven't got a support network and lots of friends already. It's a big step to come to a big city like this and sort yourself out. So
try, especially at a vulnerable age as well, in your early 20s. I mean, I did it. It was awful. And I can't say I've got PTSD and panic. You know, I struggled. Everyone I know struggled.
Yeah, it goes back to a theme from some of the other podcasts, trying to live up to what other people do, you know. So, oh, my friends have gone to London, I'd better go to London then, you know. So it's all about challenging, why do I want to do these things? And it's not to say you never do them. It's just, is this the best time to do them? And I mean, if she had been my daughter, I would have moved heaven and earth for her not to go to London, because I would know it. But that's if the mother knew that she wasn't well.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Get well first, look after yourself. You have got to be your first priority.
Yeah.
And if you're well, you can deal with so many different situations. And it sounds like she's really on the mend now. She's learned a brilliant lesson, because she's gone back, she's looked after herself, and now she's getting good results.
Yeah, and she said the staff are great as well. So obviously people know her situation and they support her when things get difficult. So glad to hear things are much better. We've had a note from a teacher. I don't know the person's name. They say, I gave my notice earlier this year and I'm considering leaving teaching for good for many reasons, but this current job sucked my soul right out. Definitely in the middle of a career crisis. It's overwhelming to be 41 and considering not just a job change, but an entire career shift. That's a big one. But I mean,
She doesn't say if she's got any idea what she wants
to
do.
No, that's all we know, I'm afraid.
Well, you know, I taught for 2 years, and every one of those 2 years I realised I shouldn't be where I was. You know, it was just, but I'd got a degree, then I trained to be a teacher, and there's a sort of thing, well, I've got to stick it out. No, you don't. Life's too short.
Mm.
So I think if she's been a teacher, obviously for some years, because she's now 41, she has hugely transferable skills. And I think we mentioned this on other podcasts. Stop thinking about the job. Think about abstract objectives. Where do I want to be in terms of my well-being? You know, do I want to be in a job where I'm told what to do all the time? Do I want to have more freedom? Do I want to be managed? Do I want to be on my own? All these things, what will make this a happy situation for me? And then find a job to fit it.
Yeah.
But she's got more skills than she knows. I think when you work, and it's not just teaching, if you work for an organisation for any length of time, you do to a certain extent become institutionalised. I mean, I worked in an organisation for 12 years and then I went freelance. And it was really a big thing. Because there were certainties when you worked in a company that, okay, it might not have been very nice. There might have been loads of things I didn't like about it. But it had a routine, it had a structure, and also you got paid on the 15th of every month, which was a big plus. Then I became a freelance, and all of that had to be rethought. And I had to also say, who am I? I'm sure for probably about 20 years she's been saying, I'm a teacher. Well, she's not anymore. And that, I know that sounds really sort of trite, but then if you're not a teacher, who are you and what are you doing? But looking at some of the, I mean, coping with children on a daily basis, all those negotiating skills that you have to have.
I was going to say the transferable skills from teaching to any other career absolutely. Are huge, aren't they?
But I think sometimes you just can't see that.
Right.
So I would, you know, I would get her to go to someone who could look at her CV and pull stuff out for her. I mean, I help people with CVs sometimes and they... after a long conversation, little things will come out and I say, why isn't that on your CV? Well, I can do that.
Mm.
Yeah, but it's transferable. Stick it on a CV.
Sell yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
What have we got here? This is an interesting one, Sue. I've received a work experience request from a privileged white son of very lovely friend. He's currently at Cambridge University and I think he'll be fine without me, but think turning him down / not helping may be unreasonable and be uncomfortable with my friend.
So she's trying to fight the class war on her own, is she?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Right. I know a lot of companies who have adopted a policy of properly managing work experience so that, for example, that wouldn't prohibit him. He could apply in the normal way, but that wouldn't mean that it's who you know that gets you the job.
Because that was a big thing at the BBC, wasn't it? I remember years ago that they had to change that they had to make it an official route in to doing work experience
yeah.
because it was becoming far too who you know. I mean, luckily when I started, it was still who you know.
Right. See, I've never known anybody, so it's never been an advantage to me. But you know, and I think that's good policy.
I agree.
And that way he could apply and I'm sure he'd be a very good candidate.
Yeah.
But if you don't have that policy, then, I mean, if I was her and it's my friend, I would probably help my friend. But perhaps what this opens up is an opportunity maybe to help other people as well. Could she have a discussion in work about how do we manage work experience? Wouldn't it be great for us if we could target schools that were socially deprived, yeah, for example? Yeah. So I think it could be the start of something.
Yeah. Instigating a diverse work experience programme where you say we're going to actively go and find people who are not going to have a foot in the door automatically with a company like ours.
But also, I mean... It's funny because when I first started applying for jobs, because we all know I'm very old, and so the early 80s, it was very much which university you'd gone to, and preference was given to Oxford and Cambridge. Now, I went to a very good university and I got a good degree, but it didn't seem to cut any ice. But where this left me was that when I was in a position to recruit other people, I could feel myself saying, if I saw an application, it had Cambridge or Oxford on it, right, come on then, we're ready for you. Now, that is as bad as doing that against someone with a black skin. It's stupid.
It's true.
You know, they're obviously clever. And that doesn't mean to say they're privileged. But even if there are privileges, that's not their fault. You know, so I don't think it's about rubbishing them, it's about bringing other people up.
That's right.
Is more positive. You know, at the beginning I was very equally balanced, chip on both shoulders, you know. but fortunately I don't have those anymore. And what I try to do is just take people on their merits, no matter what their background, creed, colour, gender, because I think that's what's more important. And I just think, you know, I hear the class war in what she's saying and I totally get it and am supportive. But I think it would be churlish not to help her friend.
I've got one here that is about, this gets into quite a bit of detail here, but I like it I want to hear your advice on this. I have recently taken a technical/product role but in the past have always been a senior editorial person. I'm very happy in the new role, but very frustrated at being told I'm not creative and should butt out of some discussions. I believe my feedback will make the product better, so I will continue to feed it feedback in politely and assertively. However, it's really irritating to be labelled as not creative. But I don't want to share my CV or say, do you know who I am? Or similar. I have done a bit of that and hate it.
I think you're the one with the problem with the labels.
Yeah.
You know, again, labels only work if you let them. And what does it matter? This whole thing about creative, we have creative people. So that ergo, everybody else is not. Everybody's creative in a different way. And I know that sounds a bit hippy-dippy. But what I mean is that people have different work experience. They have different ways of seeing things, different life experience. It's how you deal with it in the moment. So what she's saying is that she's saying something and they're telling her they actually use the words butt out.
It seems she hasn't actually put that in inverted commas. I think that's just how it feels.
Yeah. And I think that's an important factor is I want her to listen to this. Be so good. If I was talking to her face to face, I'd say, give me an example.
Yes.
Because sometimes it's not what's being said, it's what's being heard.
Mm.
I had somebody recently I was working with and she said everybody that I work with is older and it's a real problem. And I go, right, okay, give me an example when it's been a real problem. And she could think of nothing.
Yeah.
It was what was going on in her head.
Right.
She was feeling intimidated because these people were older. And I would just, you know, so I'd be making my point. If someone said, well, I mean, I'd be really interested to hear what they did say, but I would say, no, look, let me just finish my point. Now, that doesn't mean to say they'll take it up, but that's not necessarily to do with the fact that you're not creative. It just might be that it doesn't fit.
And also, my initial reaction to this is, that, and then you're in the wrong job, aren't you? If your job is not allowing you to be that person that you feel you are, as well as this new role that you've taken on, you need to go find one that can actually straddle the two.
Yeah, and what's she looking for? I mean, if I would think that someone who had initially a creative background, but then also has got a technical, how skilled is she?
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's more about the environment of that company that you're working with. And if it is very stratified and no, you don't have an opinion on something, I'd be looking for another job.
Yeah, I agree. How do I ask for a pay rise? I'm terrified of my two bosses. They're always too busy to properly catch up with. And the thought of asking for a meeting to discuss makes me feel sick. And actually, I know someone else who's actually in this exact situation who's quite senior in an architecture firm and she's feeling this way. What is going on? Bad management. I mean, bad bosses, first of all. That goes without saying.
Ish. Right, a couple of things. This asking for a meeting is making me sick. Asking for a meeting is making me feel sick. Yeah, but you've got to ask for one.
Yeah.
Right. Because you can't have this conversation in a corridor. It's got to be a meeting. And going back to what we keep saying, I'm as important as they are. OK. Then what's the worst thing that can happen? They can say no. And then what will I do about that? OK. But also, it's not just a given that you should get money. There seems to be this thing, you know, if I've stayed in a company for a year and I've still got a pulse, I should get more money. And I would be making it a business case. I wouldn't be making it emotional. So let's supposing, and I don't know enough of the detail, but supposing I've been here a year or 2 years and I'm on the same salary I was at the beginning, then what I'd be saying is, okay, what value have I added to this job in the last 2 years? So if I leave now, I'm 2 years worth of experience that they're losing. But you've got to be very businesslike about it and not moany or whingy. So I'd like to discuss my salary because, as you know, I've been here for 2 years. During that time, I have now taken over responsibility for X, Y, and Z. I can now do this. I can now do that. And I think we should discuss a pay rise. And I wouldn't put a figure on it. That's your opening gambit. And it's for them then to say why you shouldn't have one. Now, it is the case, having other information is quite useful. So, for example, if anybody else has been given a pay rise, some companies, especially over recent years, it's been quite static. Nobody's been taking pay rises because they haven't been able to. Can you in any way benchmark your job with jobs outside? So often if you look in, you know, online or whatever, you can see the sort of pay range for a job. And if it's wildly out of kilter to what you're earning, then I think you need to make that point. You know, I've looked at other jobs. They're being paid $5,000 more than I'm being paid. I'm not saying I want $5,000, but I think that pay relativity needs to be made up. And the bottom line is, if they don't give it to you and you think that you're worth more, then start applying for other jobs. I know this is a bit of a theme, and I'm concerned that it doesn't sound as though I'm saying to people just run away, because I don't mean that at all. You always, in the first instance, try and make it better where you are. But if I think I'm as important as everybody else and they are consistently underpaying me and not giving me the respect that I think I'm owed, then I'm going to go. I'm not putting up with it.
I think that's an excellent place to end, Sue. That was excellent advice. Thank you. I wish I'd had that at some points in my career when I've asked for more money. I've always gone in on the kind of slightly emotional thing, and I've always sort of sneakily found out what someone else is earning, and then they sort of say, well, that's not got anything to do with this. Oh, I don't know. I've just gone about it in a terrible way instead of actually selling myself again.
And also, be factual.
Yeah, be factual. You know, exactly.
Prepare your business case.
Yeah.
So like in anything in business, if you wanted to get an extra member of staff, or you want to do anything, you would be expected to come up with a business case for this. The reason we need this person is this. And I think you apply that same logic to yourself. You know, when I used to take on people, if they hadn't had a lot of experience, my business manager would say, right, we'll put them at the bottom of the salary scale because I don't know if this is going to work out. Mm-hmm. Now, what I always did, my business manager was brilliant at this. When they'd worked with me for about 6 months, she'd say to me, are they good? And I go, yes. And she said, well, we need to think about paying them a bit more then, because they're now 6 months down the line. They're 6 months more useful to you. If they were to go, that would be annoying and inconvenient. Now, often the pay rise you gave them wasn't huge. We didn't have a lot of scope for that. But the effect it had when your manager says to you, look, you've been here 6 months. I think you're absolutely brilliant and I'm going to pay you a bit more money. It's not a lot. They are so happy. And I think also what's at the bottom of her question is, I feel overlooked that they won't have meetings with her. They're really busy. They're not giving her any attention. Mm. So all of that is bound up in that. But you do not have this conversation until you've got all those facts in black and white in front of you and you get rid of some of the emotion.
That's it. The emotion. Oh, the amount of meetings I've cried in, and I just regret it so much. Anyway, Sue, thank you so much for your wisdom over the series and experience. This has been My Career Crisis Series 1. We will be back with My Career Crisis Series 2 at some point in the future. So we would, you know, love for you to keep in touch. Follow us on Twitter at My Career Crisis. And we will be back soon. Thanks a lot, Sue.
You're very welcome.
My Career Crisis. My Career Crisis.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.